episode 3 of Ricky Richards Represents.
If you care about the work that you do, it won't be shit. And if it's shit, it won't be shit for long, because you'll make it better.
Hello everyone, and welcome to episode 3 of Ricky Richards Represents, the show where we talk tips for success with leading figures of design and innovation. Today I'm talking to Carson Brown, the design engineer from Uniwheel, about what we can expect in the personal transportation industry and the innovations going on in engineering. Let's do it. Hello everyone, and thank you for tuning in to Ricky Richards Represents. Today I am chatting with my friend Carson. We are currently doing this in my bedroom at my flat in London, which is also Carson's flat. And so we're right on the side of a busy road, so there may well be some sound interference. Hopefully we can keep it to a minimal. But without further ado, I'm going to pass you over to Carson. Carson, could you just explain who you are and what you do, I guess?
So my name is Carson Brown. I am a design engineer. So it's basically I design consumer products, so I get to make stuff for a living, which is kind of a long-time passion of mine. Outside of that, I also do digital work, because most of my design engineering work is kind of tangible things like enclosures and parts which users interact with, but I also get to design apps as well, so that's a bit of a change.
Okay, wicked. So I guess what I'd love to talk about today is something which I'm super passionate about, but it's the personal transportation. And obviously you're an engineer creating what I would describe to people as a one-wheel Segway. I'm sure you'd be able to describe it much better than that. But I guess my first question is, could you just explain what your company is and what your role is in that?
So I currently work for Uniwheel. Uniwheel is a personal transportation company. We actually do use the term one-wheel Segways to describe to people who are kind of unfamiliar with the concept. Basically, you lean forward to go forwards and you lean back to go back, but you're just standing on two pedals either side of a single-wheeled device. So although that might sound scary, it's actually pretty cool once you get a hang of it.
Okay, so let's delve into this a little bit. So when I chat to people about this, a lot of people say kind of Segway wanker, and that is associated quite heavily with the fact that a lot of the youth culture picked up on Segways quite early, and then you saw people going along on the streets on the two-wheeler ones in particular. But it's always amazed me that we've got all these innovations in, say, the internet, and we've got planes, and we've got this, that, and the other, but for whatever reason we still walk around the streets, which is just, it's always bemused me. Why do you think it's taken this long to get to a device so that we can actually get around personally quicker?
I think that's probably a really good question. Transportation's slow, which is quite funny because it's something which usually makes you go quicker. But realistically, if you look at the way we get around, beyond just walking, you know, walking, cars, buses, planes, the way that we do those activities has not changed for upwards of 50 years. Like kind of the innovations which have gone into that have helped make them more comfortable, make them more reliable, made them more efficient. But overall, the basic concepts, they really lie within the same field. And I think what we're talking about is changing consumer habits. And as many people know, that's one of the most difficult things you can ask yourself to do.
So what do you think would change people's behavior?
I probably think that there's two driving factors which would bring people towards like the technology which we create and the technology which others, you know, we're not the only people in the industry pushing it forward. Realistically, it's cost. So I think the cost of transportation is obviously a massive driver, a massive influencer. And the other thing is time. So I'm a big fan of walking. I will happily go pace around and clear my head and things like that. But in terms of walking to work, I do live walking distance. I probably live about a half an hour walk. But if I have a choice in riding the device which we make, the Uniwheel, which takes me around 10 or 11 minutes to get to work, or walking for half an hour, I'd rather the extra sleep or the extra time to read things in the morning than having to get up early and walk that distance.
So is that realistically at the moment, these things, you could get them on Alibaba.
You can order things on Alibaba, yes.
For relatively cheap. There was the whole thing about them being set alight, which I think we'll come and talk about a little bit later on, the fact that some of them are setting on fire. But at the moment, is it merely a product which wealthy people can own? Do you know what I mean? Because for your extra 10, 20 minutes in bed in the morning, are people prepared to pay? Like, I mean, how much is the product you...
At the moment, it's retailing for £990, so...
Which is a big...
It's a lot.
That's the same. You can get a car for that money.
You can get a car for that money, but I think that if you look at kind of urban transportation and you see that the average road bike in London costs £600, we're not talking about a lot more.
Yeah.
The difference between the road bike and us is... You can just ride this to work and stop, take it inside. You don't need a lock. You don't need to take a shower. You don't need an extra pair of clothes. It really, you know, in the same way that you take a car and once you park it, you go inside. It's no fuss. There is no additional change to your
habits. So we've actually done this once, right? We were visiting a friend and we were coming from the exact same place. And I think I was on a bike. I was probably as fast over the ground. But it was the point at which I had to lock up the bike. By the time I'd got into the house, you were already there.
Yes, I was already inside.
I mean, you're an experienced rider. And is yours modified in any capacity?
No, it's not. It's exactly the same as kind of what we would send to our customers. The only difference, I think, would be, you know, the experience I have. I might be able to ride a little bit quicker than some other people. But, it is actually really comparative.
So who are the other personal transportation companies?
I think there's really only one major one which is worth mentioning. A lot of people aren't familiar, but Segway was actually purchased by a company called Ninebot. Ninebot is a Chinese personal transportation company that was actually sued by Segway 4 or 5 years ago for infringing on their patents. Now, they actually got so successful while copycatting that a few venture capital firms invested in them to help them do a buyout of Segway. So they now own the person who was suing them for infringing on their patent.
Oh, no way. That's pretty... It's insane. So what are some of the other techniques people are doing? Because there's one which you stand on with one foot, I seem to remember, and it goes around. There's a few different approaches that people are taking with this. I know that there's the boosted boards.
Yeah. There's some boosted boards are cool. Inboard. The Monolith M1 inboard is also, like, from a design perspective, that's a favorite of mine. There are quite a few kind of new longboards which have, they're really sleek. Basically, if you didn't know and you hadn't been looking into them, like, you know, in a slightly geeky way, you wouldn't realize it's fully electric until you saw the guy fly by you at almost 20 miles an hour. and that's cool. I think that's probably what a lot of people have always thought, oh, wouldn't it be so cool if you could, you know, go uphill on a skateboard and not have to push and actually ride it to work because it could be used as a form of transport.
Yeah. So what are some of the things that when you're introducing people to this product, what are some of the early learning curves people are having to go through? I know with the two-wheel Segway, I believe that learning curve's quicker. So what are some of the iterations maybe you've made on the product in order to lower that learning curve?
We do have some accessories which we've built for the product, which we hope to help that. They're not out yet. But they will be soon. But I think the biggest difference between the single-wheeled device and the two-wheel device is they turn differently. So if you think about the two-wheel device, it kind of pivots on the spot. So one wheel turns one direction, other wheel turns the other direction. It means you can spin. But what that kind of means is that you turn a little bit like a robot. Because we're one wheel, you turn much like a skier. So you're kind of always going forwards and you kind of slalom, you kind of bank through your corners and you're able to ride over things. Whereas with the two-wheel device, if you hit things, it actually causes you to spin one way or the other, which is a bit unsettling. So I don't think I've ever seen someone using them to get somewhere. It's just more something that you mess about on.
Yeah, I've noticed that. You very rarely see people using the two wheels. Whereas you burn down the street, it's like... But you've got a tendency towards your company, but, you know, is it the best on the market, realistically?
I think it's the most complete product on the market. Saying the best, I think, is always, at least from an engineering perspective, I would say is always a bit subjective.
Yeah. So it is, in terms of getting people over not only the early learning curve of actually riding the device, but in terms of making this popular, not just from an early adopter perspective, but more to like a mass market. There's this whole element around the coolness of them. You know, some people hate them like with a passion, you know. And what do you think are some of the ways you're going to be able to come over that, just from like a marketing perspective?
So in terms of, I'm going to kind of deal with that in two ways. So first, in terms of like people's perception of the product, this is the weird thing. I would say it's over 99% positive reaction to the general public. I mean, everyone from little kids who stop and like tug on their parents' legs, like, what is this? That's amazing. Up to literally old ladies who stopped me at traffic lights and said, I don't think I could ride that, but that's awesome. And I expected that coming into the company. I've been riding with friends before where I went to meet them somewhere, and on our way back to the house or on our way somewhere, they said, wow, I didn't realize like how much people thought this was cool. And it is funny because when you see people on Segway tours, I don't yell. I'm not going to lie. I'm not that outlandish, but I do think and just kind of mutter under my breath, Segway wankers. Because it's funny. It doesn't fit. You know, these things are massive machines and you're towering over everyone on the pavement. So I think it's a little bit different. And the acceptance of that to mass market isn't going to be quick. It's not going to be like a hoverboard. A hoverboard is really a toy. It's much more in the fad category.
But I think the hoverboard, the reason it blew up was because you could get them for 150 quid. You know, how long do you think it's going to take before this £1,000 device is reachable for most people, you know?
I think the prices could come down. But realistically, you can get a hoverboard for 150 quid, but it might burn your house down. You can only get a good one for 300 quid.
Minimum entry
point. Minimum entry
point. Which, by the way, for anyone listening to this, I'm going to send this around to all the companies. Please, someone send me one. I'll be your biggest advocate. Even if it's a 150 quid one that will burn my house down.
No, that's not okay. I live in this house. So if that comes in, I'm taking it apart so you can't use it.
Okay. So, fixes, cost and hassle. Yeah, so this is another thing. If you buy one of these things, there's a massive infrastructure around bicycles. You can go to the bike shop, have your wheels changed. You know, it costs you 30, 40, 50 quid. Still quite an expensive thing to have, a bike. But for me, it's not only the price point, but also how am I going to get these wheels changed if it blows or the battery gets knackered? Is it a huge investment that I can't then replace?
So I think that's always a question which we had in the outset in terms of designing the product. You know, we use a standard size tire and inner tube, first of all. And secondly, you know, we do actually pop into Evans every now and then. But secondly, I've ridden 1,000 miles on our product, and it's zero maintenance. It's not quite like a bike. A lot of people, their bikes, they don't realize you do need to service your bike. There's a lot of moving parts, a lot more moving parts on a bike than people realize. And in order to keep them running, you do need to service them. We have actually one moving part. People don't realize quite how simple in some ways it is. It's complex in others, but what that means is you don't need to really worry about changing anything. With the exception of tires, you know, people do occasionally get punctures. You can stop by your local bike shop. You're pretty much okay. You don't need to worry about the rest.
Really?
Really, well, so really.
You could go to a bike shop.
Yeah, and you can change the tire. Like I, you know, changed the tire earlier this week because we were actually testing out different tire compounds.
Yeah, but see, you're an engineer, right?
Just like a bike tire. You literally get tire levers and pop it off and pull out the inner tube and. Okay. Yeah.
Fair enough. So, what are some other areas, either within personal transportation or just innovation in general, that you are particularly excited about?
I think that the personal transportation sector for me is exciting, but mostly because of how difficult the problem is. Like how good do you have to make something before people will actually change their habits? So going up to like slightly larger transportation, we look at cars and electric cars. The electric cars on the road, like things like Teslas, things like a Nissan Leaf, are so much better than most of the cars on the road. And yet these automakers are having to try so hard to get people to buy them. I guess a lot of that is cost, but we're talking about a really superior product, and yet at the same time, they're not everywhere. It's still kind of a surprise to see them.
Yeah, I still think there's it's a small minority of the population that can chuck 30, 40 grand at an automobile.
Definitely.
I'd consider us to be on a good trajectory for our age, kind of thing. Yeah. And I certainly haven't got that money. I think our generation would be the people that would hands down buy the product. You know,
if they had the money.
If they had the money.
That's true. That's true.
And it's probably a case of in 5 years' time, these things are still going to be going. We may have that kind of disposable income. Who knows? But okay, so you're saying kind of automobiles, personal transportation.
Yeah, outside of that, I guess there are other things which I'm a big fan of, kind of consumer electronics, to be honest, in general. But in terms of specific sectors, like, I think everyone's kind of a bit worn out of phones. It's not that I don't expect things that like new in every phone. Like a lot of consumers are like, oh, there's nothing new in it, because I don't think they realize how much work it is to improve a phone, or to bring new hardware about. But I do think that in terms of like the technology life cycle, we're going to have to start looking at accessories, the Internet of Things, other devices which supplement the phone. And that's also exciting. That's something I do have my eye on. And
the Internet of Things. So this is another interesting topic, but we're already distracted enough through smartphones, computers, which computers are becoming relatively obsolete for most people, unless you do a technical job on it day to day. You know, most people don't use their computers for that much, and smartphones suffices in many cases. But once everything is smart, are we going to become overloaded?
I think that's the question. Most of the things which I'm excited about, I'm not really excited about the technology, but what's exciting is the design problems which exist. No one needs a talking toaster or a fridge which, tweets. I think Samsung came out with a fridge that tweets last year at CES. And that to me just shows like a complete misuse of design resources. What we really do need is a fridge which tells us when our food's going off. Food wastage is a massive problem. I believe we throw away 40% of our food. So can we build in technology that actually says, hey, Rick, today you've got
I've got a pack of bacon, some garlic bread, which has gone off probably now. Yeah.
It would be nice to be able to look at a list on your phone and it just be highlighted in different colors, which are basically telling you like you've got a couple of days to, you need to cook this now or you're going to waste the food and you're going to waste the money that you spent on the food. Those are the real problems which need to exist. And I don't think that it's going to be quick for those problems to be solved nicely.
And so this is another debate. I know, sorry, I feel like I'm going to sneeze. See if can I control it? You I've observed you for a couple months now, since we've lived together. And you're not heavily active on the internet, and you're not a particularly materialistic person, yet you work on consumer goods. And so are we in effect, by making all these desirable products, pushing people again away from this? Maybe it's just myself, like I have this very idealistic view of what's important in life, and it's not product. Or I like to surround myself with quality stuff that brings value to me. Anything that doesn't provide 80% joy or practicality day to day is out the door. Are we gonna start having people that don't have a ton of money spending twice as much on a product which doesn't bring them significantly better outcome? And I'm not being negative on technology, I love it. I'm just trying to think how is this going to impact us? And is it for the better?
I think it brings about an interesting question. It's about technology in general. I think we were talking about quotes earlier today. And something that I had written down, and I hope to write a blog on it at some point if I can just get back onto writing again. And it's technology is the new consumerism. And a lot of people probably say, oh, always was consumerism. But if you look at the big technology brands, you know, Samsung or Apple in particular, even if you think of Sony back in the 90s or early 2000s, these were brands. You know, these were like they're coveted just as you would covet, you know, like a luxury good. Now, the reason, the rationale might be a little bit different, but there are a lot of companies selling things really through their name. They're not necessarily good. They don't necessarily bring a lot of function. I hope that's weeded out, but realistically, I'm not sure if it will.
Is that the case? I mean, I think that, well, I suppose maybe it is. I mean, when Apple came out, I seem to remember being, their product was exponentially better than the competitor at the time. You know, it was 10x the old phones. Maybe not, but I mean, prior to the iPhone, it was a massive shift, I feel. Now other phones have caught up, but if you're in the Apple ecosystem, you feel quite happy there. And you know, for the first time in my life, I've not felt the need to upgrade my phone because it suffices. But at the same time, like, I'm not big brands have brought out devices and they've flopped, and they're brand, they're recognized brands that haven't taken off. You know, Amazon brought out the Amazon Fire, which was supposedly a terrible product. And I know, you know, everyone's trying to eat into Apple's market share, but sometimes brands don't necessarily win the day.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting statement. I mean, I would look at the Amazon Fire in particular and just say, like, it wasn't really a great product, but first of all, that was Amazon's first foray into hardware, of my knowledge, or a major foray into hardware. And it wasn't a name that was synonymous with a phone. I mean, outside of Kindles. Okay, yeah, Kindles, sorry. Definitely not its first foray into hardware.
but I guess what I'm trying to say is does it have to be, in order to jump from an iPhone to another device, does it have to be a significant improvement, like more than just this one feature? Like, I remember when Samsung would doing these piss take ads between Apple and Samsung, and it was like, I can just tap my phone on my mate's phone and transfer a picture. Well, 1% of people give a shit about that.
Yeah, I think that probably brings it back to my argument. Samsung sold features for a while, all right? Meanwhile, Apple was saying, look at this beautiful photo. Oh, look at this kid dancing that you care about. They didn't sell the features of their phone. They sold brand.
Yeah.
And people bought it. And people, like, if you go online, the way the arguments about brands, like, oh, Android versus that, and it's like, why are you defending? Like, it's almost a religion. It's almost that far. And I think that's quite amazing, because we've never really looked at technology. I don't think we've ever looked at technology products, or at least products. Like, if you look at consumer products, I don't remember people defending brands in this way, with the exception of, like, you know, audiophiles who are really on a high end or anything like that. We're talking about everyday people arguing about brands in a way that almost seems personal to them.
Yeah, which is, I believe, is true. I do believe brands are personal. I feel like when I look at an individual on the street and see the kind of brand that they're wearing, or the car they're driving, or the shoes they're wearing, you know, you make assumptions based on brand values as to what that person aspires to. And whether that's accurate or not, that's kind of the world we live in, right? When I see somebody, like, my personal reaction to somebody who's dressed head to toe in designer brand clothing is that they're like a bit of a sucker for brands, that their value system is maybe off towards the skew of materialism versus the minimalists. You know, like, every day in London I'll see a couple of people that are dressed purely for practicality, and then you see other people that are wearing a brand that's full of colour, and that their iPhone will reflect that because it's got a pink background, iPhone case or whatever. Yeah, I don't know. I think I'm probably moving completely away from the point, but I do think brands, like, represent people.
Yeah, I think there's other examples which we could look at. If you look at like Fitbit, so there were two, that's more than two. There were quite a lot of players in this kind of wearable space. I'm not really a fan of wearables. Rick will probably tell you he's never seen me wearing any wearables before. And he's never going to. And
you say that now, but what about when this thing's telling you all your, you know, I love this idea that it's going to tell me when I'm susceptible to health risks due to the fact that it's, you know, taking something from my sweat or something. You know, that's going to come.
I don't think that, at least for a while, we're going to get to the level where people who do actually stay active multiple times a week, Rick's always in the gym, are going to be getting information which is actually useful about and actionable about their health. Like
nothing they didn't already know.
Yeah, like, oh, you're feeling tired. Really? Thank you. That's fantastic. I was wondering why my eyelids were like dropping off for the past 10 minutes.
Yeah, you did 10,000 steps today. Well, I'm shattered. Yeah, I would have guessed. Like.
Yeah, I think, you know, when I was a kid, I remember there was like a craze at one point of pedometers. I don't know if anyone else remembers this, but basically like little clip-on like foot counters and step counters, sorry. And I just look at wearables and I look at it and I think like, oh, the biggest feature that these guys sell is like, see your step count for the day. And I'm like, wow, like they managed to get someone to spend 100, 150, 200 pounds on something, which they used to spend 10 pounds on and clip onto their shoe. And now it looks nice. They're happy to do more.
Yeah, so funny because the Nike Fuel Band was that, right? They changed steps into fuel and then built a massive marketing campaign around it. Rinsed loads of sport fanatics for hundreds of pounds, and I was one of these people creating that facade. You got one. No, I didn't get one. I was the one like, how can we sell this shit to people? And then, you know, lo and behold, it discontinued a few years down the line. But I think and it comes back to this thing around information and healthcare. You know, the NHS is a thing which you go to get your problems fixed rather than to have them identified. I forget what the terminology is here, but basically you identify your problems and then solve them in a pre-stage rather than wait until something's going wrong and then treat it.
Kind of like reactive versus proactive
treatment. Yeah.
I don't know if it's, you know, called that officially, but
there is a definite word that I'm trying to find that I can't find, but basically that idea. All right, I think we've geeked out for a good 27 minutes exactly. So maybe let's jump into some of the questions I've actually got here, which are a bit more quick fire.
Yeah.
So who were your biggest influences growing up and what did you learn from them?
So I knew I wanted to be an engineer from very early, like so early that people who I told that were kind of like, what is this kid on? Like, why?
I guess that when you said that when you were a kid, you used to play with pedometers. I was definitely playing with Pokemon and Pogs.
I used to sell Pokemon to kids who cared about it. I wasn't interested. I was hustling that. I mean, I had no interest in the actual game. Actually, someone explained to me today how you play Pokemon, which is...
I'm already level 6. No, I know it's sad. It's sad.
It's very sad. But to answer your question, in terms of people I learned from, a lot of them around were friends of family and a lot of people who made things. I mean, from engineers to actual, from creatively, there was a lady down the road who, I don't know if she's a professional photographer, but I remember she had her own, is it Lightroom that you developed?
Yeah.
A dark room, I think it is. And I remember actually she let me watch her develop a few photos and use her camera. I remember meeting someone who did pottery and learning that. So like there was a lot of like hands-on making stuff. I did a lot of making things with my dad as well. And that's been really valuable.
I tried to make a chair with my dad once. It was not supposed to be a rocking chair, but that's what it ended up being.
It happens.
Yeah. Okay, so basically your early childhood influences in the fact you were making.
I was making a lot.
Is there any notable individuals, like people famous, I guess?
I don't think so, to be honest.
So you're not a Dieter Rams fan?
I am a Dieter Rams fan, but...
He's the one I love.
I didn't know about these people until very late.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, I studied, I guess I did design in A-levels. But realistically, I didn't know about these people. I don't know if it's because I didn't care at the time or whether they just weren't introduced to me.
Do you believe in his principles?
Some of them. I mean, I don't think there's very much there that's bad, but...
Because there was this argument around with going back to Apple and their design aesthetic, that which follows quite like Jonathan Ive was quite heavily influenced by Dieter Rams, and it almost gets to this point where it becomes cold in its design aesthetic because it's so well designed, and that there was a little bit of a transition. Products like Jawbone had color and a bit of personality, and then you saw Apple introduce that with their lower price point kind of teenage phones and stuff.
And then bring it in with the high-end ones with this like champagne foolishness that they're doing on everything.
And I wonder if that's literally because Steve Jobs passed and then everyone was like, right, that's it. Get the garish design in because he's not going to kick up a fuss anymore. Like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I
imagine
kind of
him looking at the Rose phone and going, what is this?
Yeah.
Is
it's, yeah, I think that there are definitely like, a lot of design, minimalistic design principles and a lot of the function of the device and simplicity of the function and not having to explain how to use it. These are, to be fair, not really things which are attainable with what I'm currently working on when you're working on a concept which is so far from what anyone's ever used. But I think that you do want a lot of those features to be much like he lays out in his, the 10 rules.
Yeah. Do you have any rituals or routines that you use to help you create?
I'm a pacer.
Pacer.
I wouldn't say that pacing helps you, but it helps you.
Explain.
So I think that with a lot of things, if you are stuck, I don't know, some people are writers, some people are painters, some people are designing. It's nice to get out. Just go on a walk.
So your slow and steady wins the race.
No, it's not necessarily. Oh, I do think I'm a bit of a slow burn kind of person. I don't think many people who invent or many think people who design things have eureka moments per se, where they just click and something like, oh, I had this genius idea in 10 seconds. Usually you're thinking about these problems for like days, weeks, months, years.
I just read a fantastic book actually called Where Good Ideas Come From by Stephen Johnson. And in that book, it actually points out, because there's a bit of a myth, isn't there, around this. And I think it's because we all love the idea that someone has this spark of an idea and that's the, this massive innovation. And when you actually analyze it, not only is there a massive kind of incubation period where people are stewing on these ideas, but actually also it tends to be an amalgamation of thoughts that are already pre-existing that come together in a new way.
Yeah, it's adding. Creativity is adding. Anyone who believes that they're making something truly novel is lying to themselves and others. You are definitely standing on the shoulders of giants with any concept that you create.
You'd have to be in a dark room. There's no way. We are just all an amalgamation of our input.
Yeah.
And so when people talk about originality and stuff, it's just so, do you think it's bullshit, basically?
I do. It's not that there aren't original thoughts, but they're like modifications. They're a spin. Most often in design, the way I see it is you come up with new things by actually drilling down so far that you find a problem or you find something that someone else didn't.
Yeah, and this, so a good way that I've been able to analyze, or not analyze, I'm not sure what the right word is, but when my biggest breakthroughs have come, it's when I've analyzed a problem so deep and then stewed on it and let my subconscious kind of come into play. And it's hard to explain that to people, this idea of, your brain's at work when you're not, and that you wake up the next day and you're that much clearer. What do you think to the subconscious? Do you think that comes into play, or is that a little bit?
I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there may be some science on this, and no one argues with science, but realistically, I think that for me, I wouldn't say it's a subconscious thing. I actually think that it's like it's just like on repeat. Like, yeah. You don't, like, I don't know if it's everyone, but at least if I have something which I really want to crack, I will bring it up in my mind and think about it for a matter of minutes and then let it go until I crack it.
Yeah.
And it's relentless. So I think
when you say let it go, does that mean you're letting some serendipity happen within your brain? Do you know what I mean? For it to form a novel connection.
No, I think it's like every time you think about it and you don't crack the problem that you're looking for, you're admitting defeat, but temporarily. So it's like, okay, yeah, this battle, you won this battle, but I'm coming back.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough. What is the biggest struggle you face creatively, and what have you done, or what's your plan to overcome it?
The biggest struggles I've had creatively, I think, so I'm an engineer, I'm trained as an engineer. I do a lot of design work. That's why I guess I get to call myself a design engineer. But the biggest challenges we have...
So for someone, before you go in any further, for someone that doesn't know the difference between... In fact, this is me. What's the difference between a design engineer and an engineer?
I got to be careful not to say something controversial. engineers are usually problem solvers of sorts, technical problem solvers. So if you provide engineers with something that you need to make, if they are good, they will drill down and figure out the core function of what it needs to do and make sure it satisfies that 100%. And they will think about like the full functional life cycle of that product. So like, I don't know what I can give a good example of, but let's say a lamp. Like if you gave an engineer a product, like, I want you to make a lamp. He's going to say like, how bright? He's going to say, does it need to move? Does it need to swivel? Like, you know, is this just a fixed lamp or is this something which is like flexible? He's going to ask those kinds of questions. And then he's going to say, okay, well, if it's flexible, I'm going to make it strong because I don't want it to break. And he said he wants it bright, so I'm going to use this much power. And he's, you know, there are technical answers that take quite a bit of time to come up with. Whereas
is that like a scientific...
It's a bit more of a scientific, I would say it's a bit more scientific way, but a designer, I think it's not a completely different subset of skills, but I think the way they tackle problems tends to be slightly different. You ask a designer, like, make me a lamp, he might say, where are you using it?
Yeah.
He might then follow that up with, like, what do you do while you use it? It's a completely different,
like... So more like personable. It's about the emotion. So is this where Felipe Stark designs a bloody lamp that looks like a gun? You know, completely ignoring functionality to some degree for the feeling it gives you.
For me, the best designers they will satisfy like the function. They definitely will. But they're really, really user-focused. And it's not something that engineers can't do. But I do think that there is like a little bit of a shortfall in the teaching of engineers, in that they're not really taught to be user-focused. They're kind of problem-focused. Although the user does have its own subset of problems, if you're focusing on like the technical problems, you might not realize that you're not really making the best product possible.
I hate doing this because it's just an example that everyone falls back on, and it's not necessarily true nowadays. But is this where you end up with like an old PC? It's got 19 ports. That's the engineering perspective, because it answers all the problems that user may face scientifically. And then you've got an Apple product that only has 4 ports, but it feels good. And it's not necessarily 100% practical. Is that
I don't think we could blame engineers for complexity. What you typically find, at least in a large company, would be... Some companies are marketing focused. So like if you look at like gaming laptops, they are like ports everywhere. And the engineers will be told like, we need 5 ports, we need this. If the product is like designed as a marketing based product and it's PCs, yeah, it's ugly. But I think that the reason the Mac came out the way it is just like drilling really well down into the user. And then the engineering in a Mac is probably better than the design. And that's what's actually quite funny. If you take a Mac apart and you look at like how things are put together and you look at how structurally it is, and people don't really look at, oh, like, yeah, it's aluminium. Well, guess what? You know why it's aluminium? It's because it dissipates heat. And that's why you don't have a honking loud fan like all the rest of the other laptops you've ever used. These are engineering solutions. The touchpad, which is better than any other laptop, is better because of engineering, not because of design.
I love how passionate you are about this. It's great. I interrupted you. What were you going? Do you even remember?
Oh, I'm not bothered. If you don't remember, it's not worth it.
Okay, sorry, man. My fault. Okay, so what's one thing you've learned that's changed your life forever?
Wow.
You know, it could be career-wise, could be personal.
I do think that there was a time, you know, probably in my teens, that I was not as maybe intense or disciplined as I am now in terms of work. Some people would just say lazy outright.
I can't ever imagine that with you, man.
I think I was disinterested, but it manifested itself in laziness. And I think that one thing I have learned, and it's prevalent, you know, even with people I work with to this day, or have worked with, you know, when you take what you do seriously and you actually care, and I actually think it comes down to, it's not about like, are you lazy or you not lazy? Like, do you care? If you care about the work that you do, it won't be shit. And if it's shit, it won't be shit for long, because you'll make it better. But if you don't care, it's going to be shit and no one's going to like you. No one's going to buy your stuff.
I get that. You know, there's definite truth in that. Because a thing that I struggle with is that because I understand marketing, that I sound like a marketing profession, like a marketing person, and people don't necessarily resonate with that because it sounds not genuine, you know. People that are genuine, and by that I mean they're just doing this because they love doing it, they're the people which end up winning, because there's just no barrier between their belief about what they're doing and people's interest in them. There's no fakeness, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. We've got to push on, because the last time I did an interview, it went on for 2 hours.
All right, yeah,
we're 40 minutes in already. So, yeah. How do you think the industry will change in 10 years?
Which industry?
The kind of engineering, design engineering.
Okay, so there is one thing which is cool. It's not 3D printing. Anytime you see something like 3D print the world, like, don't read the article. It's a waste of your time. I think that virtual reality could make a difference in our industry. Everyone's been talking about it for gaming, but when you make tangible stuff, I think it could be really interesting to be able to literally put goggles on and see it in front of you from different angles and perspectives. And you know, you could take someone through the user experience of an object without having to actually make the object. And that's really weird and awesome at the same time.
That's really cool, man. One little thing that just occurred to me yesterday, because I was we're working on a game at work at the moment, and we got this super, super tech nerd in who's amazing at game design, basically. And he typed in like a few rules into his computer, and then it generated the very basic form of this game. You know, with gravity, with the ball, and all the rest of it. But what made it interesting to me was he was talking about how with the game mechanics, how he could implement the certain rules, and that he could basically get it to generate the level for us, and it would just implement the rules of the game in sporadic places throughout the course of the level, and that there would definitely be a way to get to the end, but the computer would generate it. And a question I have for you is, do you think there will ever come a time when we will be able to tell a computer what a design problem is? Like, say, for example, the casing on a MacBook, right? So these are the components. You tell the computer, you scan the components. So this is the space it's going to take up. Now, the computer algorithmically works out the best design solution.
Yes, I think there will be a time, to answer your question completely straight. But I think that people, when they use physical objects, like, you know, like a laptop, laptop's probably a really great example. They don't realize the sheer number of constraints. Your making something which is completely custom or looks completely unique, but uses some custom parts and some off-the-shelf parts, and trying to build something that, like, you've got loads of variables. And when I say variables, I mean, like, some things which are fluid and some things which are not. And getting a machine to make the right decision for each one of those is actually really, really tricky.
I suppose because of things like heat dissipation.
Yeah, you know, there's knock on it. There's amount of times that we change materials and then you get something completely random. You're like, we didn't know this was going to happen. And maybe that's where computers will be able to help us. I do think they will be able to speed us up, engineers and designers making things quite soon, because we'll be able to say, like, oh, I need this laptop to be this thick. And they'll be like, well, you can choose these components. And yeah. And we won't have to go through massive libraries of components looking for things, because it will be like, why would you do that? I've done it for you. I think that's massively cool.
Yeah, for sure. Makes everything much faster and competitive, I guess.
Yeah.
Everyone has the information at their fingertips. So resource questions, this is where we can get quick fire. So what book or learning resource has had the biggest impact on you and why? I really need to read these questions towards the mic, because that would help.
What book or learning resource?
I say learning resource because oftentimes for me it's podcasts, but you know, for you it may be this wise old man in the top of the mountains.
Oh boy, I genuinely struggle to answer that question. I read lots of short blogs. So there are a lot of blogs from hardware startup communities.
Name drop a couple.
Bolt VC, Hackcelerator. There are a lot of people who have invested in and or are making really great things with limited constraints. And they pop the hood. They've let people in and see what they've done, why they've done it, how to do it, how not to do it. I find them, I'm always on Medium, massively helpful. Ben Einstein, Bolt VC, great column. But I've looked at those more recently, to be honest with you. Over time, it's been kind of just looking at as much information from as many people as possible, as opposed to...
Here's a question for you. So I'm super into the design engineering side as well, but I'm not a design engineer.
Mm-hmm.
I love learning about new products and the innovations that are happening, but I get overwhelmed by the technical jargon. And so what is, to the best of your knowledge, the best layman's like website, blog, that someone could go and check out in order to get a taster? Is it like Wired magazine or...?
Yeah, Wired's pretty light in. I think they've got some great articles. I look at Wired every day. The Verge is also quite light in. I think that I would actually tell most people learn the layman's terms, because you don't need to understand how they work. But if you understand what they're talking about, you'll understand most articles on the internet.
When you say learn the layman's terms, you mean the like entry level industry terms?
Yeah. So I never made a game in my life, but I know that the guy you were talking about earlier was working on a physics engine, and that it basically has parameters which allow you to change how objects react in a certain scenario.
Okay, so give me the Pareto principle, five terms.
Oh boy, five terms that you need to learn for what?
So, like, for example, for advertising, I might say copy, call to action.
I don't know. I think I would genuinely struggle to give you five terms in engineering because it's so broad.
Okay.
It is. I actually think it's one of the broadest subjects. You'll never be an expert engineer. You'll be an expert engineer in like one small little tiny fraction of the subject.
Okay.
But in terms of like the information available to us on the internet, unless you're wanting to make something spectacular, in which you need to realize that you need a team, you're not going to do that as an army of one. Just learn the terms, because it's going to make reading these things actually a lot more enjoyable.
Okay, so super quickly on that, Kickstarter.
Yeah.
I'm Rick, the novice. I've got this idea for this great new thing that I want to create. Obviously, you need to have like lo-fi prototype, but the amount of time, like, I've bought products on Kickstarter that claim to be this magic product, and then I've got it and it's been nowhere near the product. And it's because there's a whole lot of engineering and production challenges that these people face. you know, is Kickstarter the answer to people trying to, for your average Joe to create a product?
Sadly, I have to say no. And it actually hurts me a little bit to say it. From the perspective of a creator, an inventor, the side, you know, at least making product, I mean, obviously Kickstarter is a lot more than just product, but I think people don't realize how difficult it is. It is genuinely difficult, and that having the limited resources, like if you look at the resources which they would spend on, you know, whatever things which you're ordering, or compared to what a big companies, you know, Dyson just spent, I think it was 50 million on their hairdryer. 50 million.
Yeah.
So many people, I think, would look at that and go, well, I looked at your fan and I look at the hairdryer. It's the same thing. And they're just completely missing the complexity and how thorough you can be. You can be. You don't have to be that thorough, how thorough you can be. So you can make a product under, like, with a fraction, a hundredth of that cost. But if you want to make sure it's really good in all scenarios, in all countries, all humidities.
So Dyson, like, just brought out the, you know, the GHD hair straightener of hair dryers.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I don't really fully understand the pitch, to be honest. But I've never used a hair dryer, so I don't think I'm their target market.
Yeah.
Realistically, all I'm getting at is that I think it's a bit of an unfair community, because what we have is people who see things they think are really cool, and just naturally we're so accustomed to seeing things that are really cool and just kicking that buy button and expecting what we saw is what we get. But the people who we're buying it from, they're really facing an uphill battle to be able to deliver something as good as what you are now convinced it is to you.
And also when you're surrounded by objects which are amazing.
Yeah.
You know, iPhones, or I say iPhones, phones, smartphones, these, yeah, just everything that surrounds us that is made by a huge global brand with millions of pounds thrown at R&D.
Yeah, I think to give an example, I think, I don't want to say the wrong number here, but I want to say that the Apple camera team is over 100 people. The camera. Now, you've got to remember, the only part of the camera which we see is the lens. So that tells you, like, from an engineering perspective, how much work and iteration and testing there is to be done to make something that you can blow up massive photos and say, photo taken by Rick. Oh, isn't it amazing in black and white stuck on the side of this building? That's how much work it takes. And those are over 100 full-time engineers earning loads of money, hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
It's not easy.
Not easy. What is your favorite movie and or documentary?
Favorite movie. I like The Pursuit of Happiness a lot. I wouldn't say it's like the best movie ever. You have Inception in your room. I really enjoyed that movie. I enjoyed that a lot, actually. Yeah, favorite movie. And what else?
And or documentary.
And or documentary.
You know, like Objectified.
Objectified. I've seen Objectified. I think there's Urbanized. And I think that the same same director has a movie on Dieter Rams on Kickstarter at the moment.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's been allowed exclusive access to Dieter's life.
Please, everyone that's listening to this, go and support that, because I would love to watch that.
Yeah, I think that's great. I need to do that myself, definitely.
Wicked. What event would you recommend people go to if they're interested in engineering?
Oh, engineering? Oh, I don't know. Design, don't go to any engineering events. They're horrible. They are literally like the driest events. I think if you want to see like the product, like as in what's come out of engineering, you've got to go to CES. I've not gone yet. I've had friends who have gone. It's kind of like our gadget show in the UK, except 10 times bigger. And, you know, everyone from around the world is going to their events to show their product to the world.
CES,
Consumer Electronics Show. And that's held, I think, in January of every year in, I can't remember. I think it might be Vegas, actually. Yeah. I want to say it's Vegas. It's on the west coast of the US.
Right, we've got 5 minutes left. I'm bringing this in on an hour.
Okay.
You ready? So what is your favorite brand? And why?
Boy. Okay, not my favorite, but the best brand that I know of.
Let me see if I can guess. I'm going Bang and Olufsen.
No.
Oh. That was a guess.
Yeah, I thought you were going to guess again. But,
okay, no.
Nike.
Nike.
Because I think that in the markets, you know, this, well, I'm big into sport, and in the markets which they hit, you know, football, basketball, it's just absolutely killer marketing.
What I mean, like, you know, I grew up in the 90s when skateboarding was like a big thing. You had all these amazing brands that were kicked off by the pro skaters. And then now it's like Nike decided to be in the skate market, and they're the best bloody skate brand.
Have you seen the SB website? Nike SB? It's beautiful.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful. The like imagery, like it, they make you feel that culture immediately. I think they nail like brand particularly. Not product, but brand, like
they're on it.
They're on it. They're really, really.
Although then their basketball trainers are ugly as hell. Sort your basketball trainers out, Nike. You need to employ me to come and give you some style, because they just look like, oh my god, man, I'm infuriated. I've been wanting to buy a new pair of basketball trainers.
Jordan Eclipses. They're nice. They're the Nike, nicest Nike basketball trainers I've seen in a long time.
Do you know, like, I remember when they used to just be, like, quite fairly minimal.
Hmm.
I used to have this pair called Reebok Off the Rims, and they were white with, like, chrome.
You play basketball, though, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and they used to have these amazing pair of Nike ID back in the day, but now they're just these big chunky things. And I don't know how they feel like these, what they're selling to try and make people think that these are in any way beneficial for they just look like you'll trip over in them.
Yeah.
Sort it out, Nike.
Yeah, they need to do something.
Okay. What do you do for fun outside of your job? This is so funny. With all my friends, we all pause and we're like, you mean life outside of work?
Yeah, I do a lot of work which is similar to work. but I, you know, I do like sport. I'm a big fan of sport. And comedy and music. I've got to get back on that, but it might bother Rick. I've been thinking about buying a pair of decks. I used to DJ at uni, and I might just do that and just put them in my room or something.
I'm a noisophobe.
Okay. Well, our headphones.
Like, nothing annoys me more than that guy that pulls up at the traffic lights with a boombox on his bicycle. I literally want to get off.
You say that guy like I have, like everyone has that guy in their life.
He appears twice a week for me.
I've not seen him yet.
He's like, where's Wally? But just like, oh, I just want to get off and punch him in the face. I'm just, this is going to be like an explicit episode, but people need to understand that music is subjective.
Yes.
And that the guy that pulls up the traffic lights blaring his music that nobody likes other than him, who thinks he's really cool.
I think that's that can be solved by technology. Just to give you a little brief outlook, they're currently working on speakers.
Is a shotgun?
Really? No shotgun. They're working on speakers that actually can play different music out of the car speakers to different people in the car. So you can actually get directional speakers.
Subjective sound waves.
Well, basically, you can be sitting there and your like brother, your sister can be sitting there and she can be listening to rock and you can be listening to rap and you can't hear each other's music.
Whoever's building that product, get me on your marketing team. Please, because I would be all over that. I'll just have podcasts on my waves. And everyone else can be listening to Bieber and all the rest of it. So, favourite quote?
Favourite quote? No, I don't have one. I do not have one at all.
Okay. That's my favourite quote. What's a fact about you that nobody knows about?
I don't know about nobody. I think there's probably people that know, but yeah, I don't do music anymore, but I can play like five instruments. And I don't do music anymore, so I don't.
So drop those instruments.
Oh man. So cello, trumpet, piano, euphonium, snare drum. What else is there?
See, the fact you didn't say triangle.
I did not say triangle.
It was a big error. No, I think when you start busting out cello, you go, God, this guy must come from a good background.
Yeah, I mean, my family, like, they were big on music early. My mom wanted us to get into music. I got good at it. You know, a lot of people get good at things as kids by repetition. I got good at it by repetition. And it enabled me to get scholarships, which and do things and go to schools which I never would have been able to afford if I wasn't as good at music as I was.
Amazing. So that's a good little life hack.
Yeah, definitely. Get your kids to do something useful.
Yeah.
Xbox is not as useful.
Play the flute instead.
Play the flute or the triangle.
And then get into a good school.
Get into a good school.
There's three sides on a triangle, so not much to master. If you could meet anyone, who would you meet and why?
Could meet anyone?
Yeah.
That is tricky. Like, are we talking about in our industry or just literally anyone?
You can't drop the sexiest girl on the planet.
No, I was actually going to say Morgan Freeman, because if you heard that guy talk, like, yeah, really, I would just a conversation, I would have him like record little things like, good morning, Carson. I'd be like, yes. Yeah, he'd be on there. He would actually be on there.
You got a pretty cool voice.
It's not Morgan Freeman, though.
True, but it's better than Ricky Richards. Do you have any projects on the go right now that people can check out? And if so, where?
Obviously, currently, as we mentioned earlier, my main place of work is UniWheel. So that is UniWheel, U-N-I, Wheel. That's all one word, .co.uk. So you can check out our site. I think there's probably links to social media and stuff on there. Other than that, there's always things in the works, but nothing that's public yet. So watch this space. I don't have social media. I do have Twitter, but I don't use it because I think it's a bad product. But that's a whole other podcast.
You can messenger pigeon Carson.
You can messenger pigeon me.
All right, wicked. And so if there was one piece of meaningful advice that you could give to people to help them live a better and more meaningful life, what would it be?
Make sure that whatever you do in life, and I say that in terms of work, I think that if you look at your waking hours, you know, probably over 2/3 of your waking hours, or even more, maybe 75% of them are spent doing work. So you may as well like it a little bit. Do something that you care about, because it makes it a lot easier just to enjoy your life, and at least you can make an impact in something that you like.
I like that. It's true. Sucks when you're at a job that you don't like.
Yeah, I don't think that's really great for anyone. And yeah, I think when people look back on their lives, it's obviously massive milestones. Like, people are like, oh, I had kids and wife, but I think if you worked at something, you'll always be like, you know, I had a great career. And although people shouldn't be career focused, and there's more than that, you do have to remember how much of your life is doing that. So you should like it. You really should.
All right, that's a great way to end.
Yeah.
Thank you, man. I really appreciate you taking the time out to be interviewed by myself.
No, thank you for your time.
I'd like to say I'll see you later, but I'll probably see you in the kitchen in about 5 minutes. You will see
me. I'm getting hungry, realistically. So.
All right, yeah, man, wicked. Cheers, Rick. Well, yeah, no worries. Bye for now. All right. Hello everyone, before I leave off, I just want to thank you all for tuning in to the next episode of Ricky Richards Represents. Obviously, this is still in its infancy, but we are now across all platforms on iTunes, Stitcher, and even on SoundCloud. So I'd really appreciate it if you could share the podcast and also subscribe. And if you really, really, really want to do me a massive favor, then if you could go give us a rating on iTunes, that does a massive service to us. It helps us boost our ranking and get more people listening to the podcast, which means that I can do more of these in the future and hopefully get more and better guests on board. So thank you very much once again for listening to the show. I hope you've enjoyed it, and speak again soon. Bye for now.